Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Everybody, thank you for sharing your evening with us. We really appreciate your listening and sharing with us this time. I want to thank Ken Quiet Hawk for that amazing intro. You can find him and his wife at nativestorytellers.com. Please do check out their website. It is amazing, and they represent a way of recording history that has been forgotten by the textbooks. It's really important that we remember it. Excuse me. Also, if you like tonight's show or any of the other ones that you've listened to on our YouTube channel, please subscribe to us. Help us build our numbers so that we can kind of spread our wings and hit a bigger audience. Tonight, Mark has an amazing guest. We're really excited to have her with us. And I know that Mark is excited because she comes from his neck of the woods, and so they have a great deal in common. So I think we're going to learn a little bit more about West Virginia than any of us knew beforehand, and especially about its history and the mounds that are there. I'm really excited because, of course, this is one of my areas that I'm fascinated with. So without further ado, Mark, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you, Barbara?
Doing well tonight. Thank you.
Good. Yeah. It's our second exciting show of the week.
Right, yeah. It is exciting.
Yeah. And, you know, we have, five authors, you know, not even counting tonight, but, you know, we have like five authors coming up over the next 3 weeks who are giving Nightlight some of the first interviews on their new publications. Next week is going to be more of a lot of international settings in the Göbekli Tepe area and, you know, the people in Dalmatia, Split, Spain, France. Maybe even Worksop, Sheffield, and the Rotherham Triangle might be mentioned too. But, you know, keep checking BarbaraDeLong.com in the calendar to see who's coming up. You don't want to miss next week's show. Tonight is another exclusive, more or less an exclusive radio interview for a recently published book, Woodland Mounds in West Virginia. And our guest is Darla Spencer. Benjamin. She is a leading archaeologist in West Virginia and also has published a book on the Fort Ancient culture in West Virginia entitled Early Native Americans in West Virginia, the Fort Ancient Culture. Hi, Darla. How are you?
I'm great. How about you?
Oh, I'm fine. Just keep moving along with all these authors, and you know, we're just really glad you're making your debut with us tonight, and you know, we're colleagues from the same state. You know, I just want to get worthy local authors on our show. And as we get started tonight, I want to read a passage that is applicable to our subject for tonight. On page 182 of Squire and Davis's Ancient Monuments of the Mississippi Valley, they write, a trip of exploration made with special reference to this and kindred points disclosed the fact that between the mouths of the Scioto and Guyandot rivers, the hills upon both sides of the Ohio for the entire distance were studded with mounds. And those, you know, that area would include you know, West Virginia, Ohio, and Kentucky. If Squire and Davis would have canoed up the Kanawha River, they would have had the same sites of mounds lining another 60-mile stretch of the Kanawha River Valley, and there would have been even more mounds if they would have gone further up the Ohio River. However, most modern researchers have pretty much avoided studying West Virginia's rich prehistory. However, you have been changing that perception of our state. You become a leading voice for West Virginia's archaeology. You know, Darla, do you have an idea of, you know, maybe other than the industrialization, why are we being just like avoided by most researchers when so much is right here?
I don't think it's so much a question of being avoided. We just don't have a lot of active archaeologists in West Virginia that that write, do research, and write books. Most of the other states surrounding us, Virginia and Ohio, for example, have lots of publications about different times in prehistory and the mounds. And we just haven't had that so much. I can't think of really anyone that's done much writing in West Virginia.
Well, you have two books.
Right. And those are the first ones basically on these topics that, I mean, they're publications in journals and that type thing, but not really any books. So I thought that was something that needed to be rectified.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you there. And hopefully we'll motivate some people tonight and as they listen on the archives in the future. But you stayed in Woodland Mounds in West Virginia, that there were over 400 mounds in West Virginia, and Dr. Webb and his Adena people notes, you know, a huge cluster of them in the Charleston area, and the Bureau of Ethnology collection of publications, 5 and 12, cover many of the mounds and, you know, their maps. So, you know, we know where a lot of the mounds were located, you know, general idea of, you know, these clusters were located. But you know, obviously, you have to scale, you know, you can't analyze 400 mounds, but, you know, you scaled, scaled it back to 16 of the most prominent mounds found across the state. And there is a lot of diversity. By analyzing all the artifacts and reading all the field notes, and what did you learn about the Adena people from West Virginia?
Well, a lot of the materials that you find in the mounds, of course, they're burial sites, and we think that probably only a fraction of the population was buried there, and they may have been important people in the group. But the things that they were buried with, beside being personal possessions like pipes, they were probably honored with these burial, with these items. And in particular, I was fascinated by the many pipes that you find in the mounds, and just the workmanship was amazing. And you think that these people had stone tools only to use. I was fortunate enough to get a fellowship last year from the West Virginia Humanities Council that allowed me to go to some of the museums and photograph artifacts from the mounds. A lot of that is out of state, of course, and this was for the book. A lot of the things that were excavated during the Bureau of Ethnology's excavations back in the 1880s are now at the Smithsonian Museum Support Center in Maryland. And so I was able to photograph those, but just the workmanship is amazing. I mean, there were artists and artisans in these groups of people early on. And again, they had stone tools to work with, and these things are polished. They're perfect. There were a lot of animal effigy pipes that I'm particularly fascinated by. Pottery, different types of tools and ornaments, marine shell gorgeous, and there was a lot of copper. And you find, of course, you don't find copper in West Virginia, so it was traded in, and there appeared to be a huge trading network between the Gulf and Atlantic coasts and the I think the Great Lakes region of Michigan is where a lot of the copper came from, and the Ohio Valley. And West Virginia participated in that somewhat. So just the things you find are just amazing there, you know. For the time, the workmanship and everything was just tremendous.
And we're talking about the Adena and the greater Ohio River drainage. What time period are we looking at?
This was what archaeologists call the Woodland period, and during the early Woodland, which began around 1000 BC, is the beginning of the Woodland period. But you don't find the mounds until after about 500 BC. We don't have dates for too many of the mounds in West Virginia. The ones we do, like the Grave Creek Mound, was built around 200 BC. I don't think we have any dates for any of the Kanawha Valley mounds, but they probably were the same time frame because we found the similar types of items in the mounds. And it lasted for a period of time, and then in the greater Ohio Valley, centering around Chillicothe, the Hopewell people, who are basically the same folks as the Adena, but they began to make the huge earthworks and things you find in Ohio. We just don't have those here. So even though the people here seem to still trade and all with the Hopewell people in Ohio and different areas over there, we have some items that were considered Hopewell, but we don't have any earthworks or anything that would be, you know, were attributed to the Hopewell. So it's basically the Adena people, which were the first mound building culture in the Ohio Valley.
And were there any foundations of homes found, near the mounds? Were there villages, or were the dead barged from the place they died up and down the riverways and then buried at these necropolises? Do we know where they lived?
Where they lived? They lived fairly close to usually a short distance away, but we don't have very many habitation sites or villages that we've found. There are a few, and they did live in, you know, circular houses. They had pottery, but it's not usually right at the mound, but it's a short distance away. And I read recently something I didn't know, that they think that there's probably a village under the city of South Charleston, which makes sense. Because that's one of the larger mounds in the state.
Mm-hmm. At the Creole Mound?
Right. That's the second largest in the state. And that was excavated back in it began in 1883.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so when we look at the Bureau of Ethnology books that discuss a lot of the contents of the mounds and who was
right.
buried there. Who were the people who were buried in the mounds, or is it just some of the culturally chief type shaman people?
Probably, because there weren't very many people buried in the mounds, and they were probably some sort of leaders. Obviously, most of the people were buried elsewhere, and like I said, we don't have a lot of habitation sites that where the other people would have been buried. There are a few, but not too many. But we think just because of that, they probably were a person of standing.
Okay. And Colonel Norris's notes seems like most of the people or the deceased were adults, but you do draw our attention to examples in your book that early middle Adena mounds, like the Willow Island mound. It was actually a very simple burial for a few people, but it also contained a child burial, and you may find that more frequently in Ohio, but not really. It's not really documented too many times in the West Virginia literature about child burials.
Right. Some of the mounds that had, like, I think the Katiga mound had children also, had both men and women and children. But depending on the number of mounds, and a lot of this probably relates to how long the mound was used. Most of these mounds were accretional, which meant that they were, you know, some person passed and the mound was first built. Sometimes it was a cremation burial. Sometimes it was in a log tomb. Some of the mounds have a log structure underneath them where there was probably like a mortuary facility where the dead was treated or whatever. And then that was either burned or the mound was erected over it. But over time, more individuals would be buried in the mound. And I believe at Katiga, over time, that's probably what happened. And then they were, you know, as people died, they would be buried in the mound. So you do find some children, but that's not real typical.
Yeah, I've noticed that, and it's really it's noted in, you know, like I said, in your book and Dr. Hemming's field notes. But you just don't see child burials too frequently. You know, maybe a little bit later from the Fairchance Mound, but it just, yeah, there's just a lot of scarce information on how children were treated at death. And, you know, I'm glad you brought that out in the book. And then, you know, you also mentioned that the adults were usually buried with the horizontal log tombs that could actually be very large for, you know, like a lot of the guys were like 5'6", 5'7", 5'8", you know, about the same size as I was, but you know, the actual tomb was like maybe 10 feet long or more. But there's also, you know, Colonel Norris draws our attention to these vertical log tombs, and that like they were more like log cabins where the mounds were built around or and on top of these, like, you know, houses. You know, have you looked into that? I just thought that's really intriguing with his drawings that you frequently see about the Creole Mound and the Smith Mound.
Yeah, again, they probably were more mortuary structures where the dead was prepared, and then sometimes they were burned. Yeah, that's what we think, that a lot of those had those structures underneath. And we find the posts, you'll find the post molds to show where the, you know, the posts were. And even at the Creole Mound, there was one. Mm-hmm. And they have wood from it at the Smithsonian.
Yeah, it's interesting to see that there were several examples of these log cabins in the South Charleston, Dunbar area. And it's not really documented in the northern part of the state. While you were preparing your book, did you notice some of the differences between the northern and southern parts of the Ohio River Valley or the state?
Not so much, and mainly because, the what we have, what we know about it is spotty, and it depends on how it was excavated and that type thing. For example, the Grave Creek Mound was excavated in 1838, so their method of doing it wasn't very uniform, and they dug tunnels in at different points and did find remains, but it's just, I guess it just depends on how it was excavated and when, and that information is just not easily available. I mean, a lot of the mounds have not been excavated at all, which is good because they are burial sites, but the methods of excavating today are so much more uniform and, by level and different things, and they keep a lot of notes, and it's just a lot more scientific.
Yeah, and a large portion of your book deals with the Grave Creek Mounds. I've had a few guests mention it. We haven't really gone to a whole lot of detail. You came up here, did some research on it, but the cover of your book is of the Grave Creek Mound. Why was this mound built to be 70 feet tall? Do we know anything about the importance of the people buried in it to make this such a like a it's really a skyscraper from
Right.
prehistoric times?
Right. It's the largest mound in North America. And it was a bit larger before the excavations. I think, and what I found during research, there's just not a lot available about a lot of these mounds. It appeared to be, I think there were two burial places in the mound. I mean, they dug tunnels in at two different points and found burials. And so over time, it was used. Again, it was accretional, and it was used, over time. And we don't know how much time elapsed. We don't have really good dates. There's not any really real way to date some of that. I'm trying to think what I wanted to.
Oh, you were talking about it was accretional and
Right.
then
And it hasn't been totally excavated, which is good, but
mm-hmm.
it was, like I say, they just dug tunnels in. So there's a lot of information that we just don't have about that.
It you note that the first stage of building of the mounds contained two burials, and that was seems like it was probably a husband and wife. Are we able to prove that was the case. You know, do we know of any of the bones surviving that could be have DNA tests done on it?
I don't think that would have shown anything. Well, I know they haven't done that. But I don't know that there's just not enough information. And I don't know, I'm not even sure where the burials are from those, but they might be at Grave Creek. But they can't do DNA testing on Native remains without going through the NAGPRA process, which is a law that was passed in 1991, and it allows Native Americans, particularly if they can show a relationship, to actually say what can and can't be done to those. So, and they wouldn't be related by blood, so it wouldn't be, they wouldn't show anything anyway. But it could have been, you know, a chief or a person of standing and his wife, but there's just no way to know.
Okay. Well, it's just something interesting to ponder, and it's just going to remain a mystery. And what the upper burial is, that the one that had the abundance of seashells?
Right.
Okay.
And again, those are, you know, from the Atlantic or the Gulf Coast, so those were trade items.
Okay, so as you know, we look at some of these burials in the far stretches of the Ohio River Valley. We are seeing how extensive the trade network was at this time. You said the shells are coming from the Gulf Coast?
Either the Gulf or the Atlantic, either. I think they have them in both.
Wow.
There's two types of shells you find, and you find those in a lot of mounds.
Okay. And the a lot of people are impressed with the overwhelming size of the mounds, but when you walk around it, you're not going to realize that there was actually a moat or a henge surrounding it that filled in over time. That seems to be the henge seems to be a kind of a unique feature. What do you make of the henge?
Well, it was more of a moat, right? I mean, that's what was surrounded the mound. And then there was a crossway, I assume, leading into one of the tunnels. I don't know the purpose. I don't know. I mean, there's just no way to know what they used it for. I mean, it wouldn't have been defensive, I don't think, because there was no one in there except for burials. We just don't know a lot about that. We know it was there, and that's the only mound that I know of that had that feature.
When we look at some of these, like the moat with the passageway across it, is there any evidence of the archaeoastronomy being engineered into these burial sites? It's more prominent at the Hopewell sites, like the Octagon Mound. But were the Adena people as heavily involved in the archaeoastronomy as the Hopewell would be, 200-300 years later?
Well, it's hard to say. I don't know that that's the case. We don't really know anything about that, about their beliefs or their religions or whatever. I mean, there's just no way to know. There are no written records at that time, so we don't know a lot about the folks, actually.
Yeah, that's the archaeoastronomy. It's been a new area of study, and people have really analyzed like the Octagon Mound, and it's like
right. You
can't even reproduce what the Hopewell people did, even with today's like laser transits. They were very accurate. It's just a really interesting subject that's just emerging now. But after covering so many of these mounds across the state, what's a mystery that you would like to see solved? Like the archaeoastronomy could be one. What's something that you are really fascinates you about what the Adena did in our state?
Well, I'm just fascinated by the whole thing, and it's not knowing a lot about their culture, and all you have to go on are items that they made. It's just amazing to see, like I say, the artistry and different things. But I can't think of anything that, because we don't know so much, that well, like the archaeoastronomy, they don't. That's not really something archaeologists do. That's more of sort of an offshoot, I guess. And I don't know a lot about it.
And some of the artwork that you feature in your book, like the the Cressup turtle. And
right.
The shoveler duck,
mm-hmm.
from the Welcome Mount. We need to stop and take a look at those items. Those two artifacts just really show the high degree of artistry found throughout this region. Did you photograph the shoveler duck? Okay, so that's your photo. Can you tell us about how big of a artifact is it? Is it like a foot long or something?
It's around a foot long, I would say,
Yeah.
And it's amazing. Again, with stone tools. I mean, it's polished, it's perfect, it's beautiful. And that the artistry is just amazing. That's one of the things I took away from it.
What color is it?
it's kind of a dark, it's not quite black, it's almost black. It's a dark, kind of a grayish brown.
Okay.
It is a very neat looking artifact. And what was the purpose of it?
It was a pipe.
Oh.
And a big pipe. But yeah, a lot of those were pipes. And a lot have animal effigies or in the shape of some sort of animal. But again, with stone tools, it's just incredible.
Okay. And what was the Cressip turtle? What role did it have with being placed with a deceased person? Do you know much about that?
Not a lot, and that's sort of another mystery because it was a tablet, what they call a tablet, and they came in different shapes, but that's one of the more unique ones because it is a turtle form. But and they were found in the burial sites, but we don't really know what their purpose was.
Cool. Let's see what some of the other questions here. And as we have some of these examples of the pipes and the effigy tablets.
Right.
Later, and I don't want to jump too far ahead of myself, but we also have the underwater panther carvings that were found in Mason County, and we're going to hear more about Mason County and the Mothman and more of that kind of backgrounds of strangeness, and my ancestors are from there, so it all fits together. But you get the this panther artwork that's located at the Tuendui Park.
Right.
Yeah, this. The artwork that you document in your book, as well as in your For an Ancient book, this is a strong tradition from about 2,000 years ago up until the underwater panthers, maybe 300-400 years old. It's more recent, isn't it?
Right.
But there's a lot of artistry found throughout the state. Can you tell us a little bit about the panther stone tablet?
Well, it was actually you've seen it, right? I mean, it was
right.
A large cutout. It was found in a creek bed in Mason County. The carving, and the man that owned the property, and I can't remember his name, but he cut it out of the creek bed, and he made steps to, actually it was to get on his horse. But the underwater panther was a deity that was, I think it was the Algonquian speaking people had, and it was sort of the underworld figure. And I don't know a lot about that, but that's where that came from. But there is, there's just not a lot of artwork, but there is some.
Mm-hmm. I've been impressed with it. I'm just glad you're just drawing our attention to it. And
right.
The photography you did for the book. You're at Smithsonian, taking photos, the Pennsylvania
Penn Museum.
The University of Pennsylvania, and in another one of your publications, you also have photos of some of the artifacts from the Dunbar Mounds, like the mica sheet from the Smith Mound.
Right.
Some of the wood from the catacomb mound. Is it like going through the process to get the permission to photograph? Is it a challenge? You have to fill out a lot of paperwork. And with all the researchers we have in the audience, if they want to go to some of these museums and take photographs and for their articles, what can they expect to go through in this process? Because it is very important.
Sure, and it's not too difficult. I've worked at the Smithsonian several times. I got my first fellowship in 2004, so I've been there several times, and those people are really great to work with. I mean, if you're doing serious research, you just have to contact them and let them know what you're doing, and then set up an appointment to go visit, and they basically let you go through they have everything housed in cabinets, in drawers, and take out the artifacts, and they have a place to photograph it. And all they really ask is that you give them a copy of the publication when it's completed. I also worked at the Carnegie Museum on the Crescent Mound. That's where the turtle is now.
Oh, okay.
And basically the same thing. The people, the keepers of these collections are very nice and accommodating. They want this, they want these things to be published. So they work with you on that, and it was a pretty pleasant experience at all those facilities.
Okay. And you have another interesting publication, 120 years later, look at the Kanawha Valley Mound Complex, and you worked with a number of people to plot on a modern street grid where it's most likely a lot of the mounds that were located on Colonel Smith's farm in Dunbar were located. It was just a huge, I guess it was probably just a huge pasture. It was like a 500 acre farm. So, there wasn't the modern streets there at the time. But as the city of Dunbar grew, kind of lost sight of where most of the mounds were, but you worked on this publication to give us a pretty close proximity of where the mounds would be located today. How did you go about doing that? Like finding the Smith Mound was located on 18th Street.
Well, actually, I can't take credit for that. One of the early Archaeological Society members did that we're locating the locations on the mound. Of course, Mound School, there was a mound there, so some of that was obvious. But he was able to find some of the locations of the mounds, and there's a good article on one of the West Virginia archaeologists. I don't remember which number, but he used deed books and different things to, find the properties and locate the mounds. And he was able to find quite a few.
Okay. And speaking of the West Virginia, one of these articles is in the one of the West Virginia Archaeologist magazines.
Right.
If people want to learn a little bit more about the West Virginia archaeology, even there are some articles about Ohio archaeology there, like Dr. Grieber's Continuity and Contrast article. That's
mm-hmm.
Probably been one of the most well-received publications in archaeology in what, the last 20 years or so. That's in one of the West Virginia Archaeologist magazines.
Right.
Could you tell the listeners like how they can go about looking for publications that might be able to help them with some of their research?
Sure. There is the West Virginia Archaeological Society has a website, and it's wvarch.org. They can look that up, and they have listings of all the archaeologists. It started in 1949, so there are quite a few, and you can get PDFs of all those. You can purchase those. They're like $5 or something and download them. But there is a wealth of information, and it's been published for many, many years. And there are other publications on there. My book is on there, I believe. So that's a good place to start.
Okay. And if people want to learn a little bit more about some of these artifacts and the Adena in the Charleston area, there is the South Charleston Interpretive Center that people can go to and stop in, say hi to Gloria and Lil. What's at that museum? And it's just right down the street from the Creole Mound. That's what, about 3-4 blocks away.
Right. That's one of my favorite places. Those folks are just so nice, and it's not a very big place, but they have artifacts. People have donated artifact collections, so they have a range of artifacts from different time periods. The photographs, when I did my first, I think it was 2008 when I went to the Smithsonian and photographed artifacts from the mounds in the valley, the Kanawha Valley, and a lot of those photos are there. And the people that work there, Gloria and Lil, are just very helpful and will answer questions. I had my first book signing there on this book. And I would highly recommend if people are in the area to try to visit. It's a great little place. And they'll answer your questions if they know the answer. But there's a lot of history in there.
Okay. And as we can just look at the street layout map of Dunbar in the 120 years publication. you helped with. And, you know, we know the mounds, you know, were located here and there. And if you read Colonel Norris's reports of the mounds, he talks about the stone mounds on top of another terrace that looked down onto the earthen mounds and the Kanawha River Valley. Do we have any understanding of the purpose of these stone mounds? I think that's just really intriguing. You get, you know, the two different mediums
right.
being used, different elevations. Are they contemporaneous, or are the stone mounds later? Do you know anything about them, or are they still there?
I don't know that they're there. I did a survey years ago on the Lower Kanawha Valley, and there was several of those. They were burial places as well. And I know that one, and the thing with the accretional mounds is a lot of times a later population would bury some of their dead in. So it would, over time, they got later and later. And I know that there was a child buried in one that had a stone, an iron axe or an axe.
Mm.
So that was like a European item. So that was pretty late burial. But I don't know that they were Edina. We don't really know a lot about those. I don't know that they're datable. That's part of the problem. Or I don't know that any have been tried to be dated.
Okay. That's something to consider.
Right.
You know, okay, and you know, we do. I think you mentioned in your Woodlands book that in the catacomb mound there was corn found in there. Okay. We have corn appearing maybe a little earlier than usual. And, you know, traditionally thought of. Do we know much about the horticultural practices of the Edina? You know, they're obviously growing some stuff, eating, you know, deer and game from the woods, but you know, do we know much about other gardening skills?
Well, they weren't farmers. They didn't actually have corn to grow. They didn't grow corn at the time. Corn didn't appear in the in West Virginia until after 1000 A.D., and that's more the Fort Ancient period. But this was really kind of unique to find corn in the bottoms of some of the mounds, and probably it was a ceremonial item, probably traded in because, again, they didn't grow it then. The corn did kind of make its appearance in Ohio, the Ohio area, farther down the, you know, the valley. So it wasn't a major crop. They didn't, until after 1000 AD, you didn't find farming villages, but they did have domesticated plants, and these were plants like Chenopodium, and they were just some of the kind of weedy plants that they cultivated. I mean, they didn't necessarily plant those, but they would kind of take care of them, so they would come back every year. But it wasn't really farming as you think of it, as the Fort Ancient people did.
Okay. When
so the corn. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Darla.
Well, the corn is intriguing because, again, it's a very early instance of corn, and I've kind of reached out to other archaeologists Brad Lepper in Ohio, and if he knows of any instances of corn in the mounds, and he didn't. And so that's something I'd like to do more research on, just to see, you know, instances of corn in mounds. And that's a very, very early occurrence of that in this region.
Okay. It's another fascinating subject. And,
right.
And as you get into, you know, West Virginia's later history at the Fort Ancient Peoples, how is that culture different from the Adena approaching about 1,000 years later? What did you find in your research about these people occupying about the same area about 1,000 years afterwards?
Well, the Fort Ancient people were some of the first farmers. They were very sedentary. They lived in villages along the rivers, and they did grow corn, beans, and squash, and that's after corn had made its way to this area. They lived in circular villages. Again, we don't know a lot about the Adena villages in West Virginia. There haven't been too many documented, but they did, obviously, they lived fairly close to the mounds. But the Fort Ancient people no longer built mounds. They buried their dead in the village. But they were farmers, and that they hunted to supplement, you know, their diets. That was after the first bow and arrows appeared, so they used bow and arrows for hunting, where the Adena used spear points or spears. So it was a different lifestyle. And the Adena, the focus has always been on the burial mounds, because that's what's visible, that's what remains.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know too much about their way of life. You know, we just know about that one feature pretty much, where the Fort Ancient people, and in my other book, I talk about the Fort Ancient people, and, you know, you know more about their lifestyles and their artifacts were, they had gaming pieces, they gamed, they did maybe even bet on things, we don't know, but, and they had different pottery. They were just a lot more sedentary, more settlement village life.
You mentioned games. What types of games were they playing 1,000 years ago?
Well, we don't really know for sure, but they do have gaming pieces. And they're round little disc-like pieces. We find those at several villages. It could have been some sort of a betting game, or it could have been something similar to Chunky, which was a game that was played by Native Americans in North America until historic times, I think. I don't know a lot about the game in itself, but you find a lot of leisure items. You'll find little bone flutes or whistles made out of turkey leg bones, so we know that they had music.
Wow.
And just a lot more. It almost seemed like they were struggling less to survive as the Adena were. The Adena probably had a pretty rough life. It was, they didn't have farming, they didn't have the crops, so they had to hunt, you know, for. And they domesticated the plants to supplement their diets, but the Fort Ancient people had more leisure time.
I'm not sure
they hunted and stuff, but, you know, they did have, you'll find little, from leftover pieces of clay, you'll find little pieces of figures and different things, maybe made for the children when they did the pottery.
Okay. Really no like clay figurines, you know, like for children really existed during the Adena period then? So we see.
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Not that I've seen.
I haven't read anything about that either. I just developing an interesting contrast and the social development in your Fort Ancient book, it is. Do we get any information about the palisaded villages? You have like some an aerial photo of one of them.
Uh-huh.
Is that right?
Right.
It was a circular village. What were they starting to have? Walled villages at that time?
Well, they were circular villages. Their houses were made of logs, but they were in Adena period too. They did have a palisade, so there may have been, and you don't find that at Adena villages that we know of. So it may have been increased warfare, and that could have been for different reasons.
Is there a reason for increased warfare hostilities? Do you have any idea about that at this moment?
It's just theory, of course, but it could have been, different groups raiding the crops of other groups. They built palisades for defense. But it's just hard to say there are no written records, of course, and it's just hard to know for sure. But that's probably what it was. And maybe just depletion of one area, and then they would, go to a different area and try to take things from another group.
Okay. And since we've covered a little bit of the captivating stone artwork, we have yet to introduce the Kanawha Madonna. What do you think about
mystery?
What do you think of that at the cultural center?
I don't know what to think. I don't know. We don't know much about that, when it was built or by whom, or it's kind of a mystery all around.
Yeah, it is. The figure carrying a little teeny tiny little baby buffalo, or what is it? It is something that is on display. It's from a 400-year-old tree or something like that, 500-year-old tree, but it makes you stop and wonder about the artistic expressions that someone was doing at that time. The animal does look like it could be a child holding a baby buffalo. Do we know if buffalo were roaming the Kanawha Valley at that time, or?
No, they weren't.
Within the state?
No. There's no mention of buffalo, and there's no buffalo remains found at any of the sites in West Virginia. They didn't come into the valley until much later. And I know in the 1700s, when George Washington visited, there were buffalo. You know, they talked about buffalo back then, but there were no buffalo remains found at any of these sites. So they weren't here then.
Okay. And yeah, do you have any book signings coming up? You were just in Charleston doing one a couple weeks ago. Do you have any?
Right.
No, I'm sorry. And yeah, you have one coming up on the 23rd. That was
right.
Is that one downtown?
That's on Capitol Street. Yeah, Taylor Books. Bookstore downtown.
Okay, and the one at the South Charleston Interpretive Center was a couple weeks ago. So you have one
right.
Coming up on the 23rd, and we have Archaeology Day that people can attend. That one is being held at the Grave Creek Mound,
right
in Moundsville. What is Archaeology Day?
That's in October. Archaeology Month is October in West Virginia, and they have different people come in and do flint knapping. They have a lot of collectors bring their collections. I'm going to be there this year, and they have people doing demonstrating atlatl throwing and flint knappers. Demonstrating flint knapping and that type of thing. So it should be a nice, nice day.
Okay. October 5th. Where do people get your books?
They're on Amazon. Both of them are on Amazon. They have it up at Grave Creek Mound, and Taylor Books is carrying it as well. But the easiest place would be Amazon.
Okay. And you'll be able to autograph some.
Sure.
At your appearance at Taylor Books.
Right.
I think you made some interesting cases. West Virginia has a lot of unexplained mysteries that yet to be solved. Where is West Virginia archaeology going in the future?
It's hard to say. There have been a lot of excavations, most of us driven by like consulting firms doing archaeological projects and that type of thing. And then they put out reports. Now those aren't necessarily available to the public, but there are articles in the, like you mentioned, the West Virginia Archaeologist about a lot of these projects and, you know, the things they find, like the Burning Spring Branch Village was found by a project that the company I work for did for the Army Corps of Engineers for the Marmot Lock replacement project, and they found the village up there. So a lot of this comes out in that way.
Okay, and speaking of the Marmot Locks, there, you know, some of these really deep antiquity type sites, like the Buffalo site, were found because of the building of the modern locks and dam systems. How has that changed our understanding of West Virginia's prehistory?
Well, projects like that discover sites, particularly if they're on the rivers, because that's where a lot of the people live. Along the rivers too. That was their trade network, and they're probably the way they got around. So, you know, we know a lot more about it because of these projects. And because you can't just go and dig like people used to, or it's not a good idea to do that, you know. These type projects uncover sites that wouldn't be found otherwise.
Mm-hmm. As we got started talking, you spoke about you had a grant to do some of your research. Mm-hmm. You know, for the listeners out there, how does one go about doing that in their state to get funding to write a book, you know, get you know, the travel costs, film development, going to all these museums to examine artifacts. What's the process?
Well, in West Virginia, we have the West Virginia Humanities Council. I'm not sure what type of organizations are in other states, but here you go to through the Humanities Council. They have a calendar every year to apply for grants and fellowships, and it's funded by the National Humanities Program. I believe their fellowships come out in April, but you just have to show that you're doing serious research, or you're writing a book, or you need to visit some museums or that type thing, and fill out an application, and then they choose certain ones each year. But they've been very helpful. They've been, I've had several grants from them, and they've funded a lot of archaeological projects in the state in particular. So I'm a big fan of the Humanities Council. And like I say, I don't know what types of organizations they have in other states, but they probably have similar things, because this is a state affiliate of the national program.
Okay. And we can go for a few more minutes. Is there anything else you want to cover about West Virginia's prehistory? Just go patronize the museums, South Charleston Interpretive Center.
Right.
The Blennerhassett. The museums are kind of few and far between, but if you know where to go, you know, like the Grave Creek Mounds Museum for the Artifact Day in October, it's, you know, you're going to learn a lot. Do you have any concluding remarks on where some of your favorite places to go to learn about West Virginia's rich prehistory?
Right. Well, one of my favorite places is Grave Creek Mound Archaeological Complex, and that's a wonderful facility. It's on the grounds of the Grave Creek Mound. They have a museum there. They have collections from the mound, and a lot of different functions go on there. They have a bookstore, and they house a lot. They house it's the repository for archaeological collections in the state. So everything from federal projects companies do, that all winds up there. The people up there are great to work with too. But those type of things, and then they have Archaeology Day. They have a lot of functions like that. That's, I think, our premier museum in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Blennerhassett Museum and...
the Stahl Collection.
Right. And, yeah, there aren't a lot, but we have some great ones. And the Interpretive Center, I love that little place.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, all right. Barbara, do you have any final questions you want to ask?
No, I think she's done a magnificent job of filling us in on, again, you know, one of those areas that is not common knowledge to a great many people. And knowing that there are so many mounds out there that are yet to be investigated, not necessarily excavated, but certainly looked into as much as they can without destroying them, I think it's fascinating. It's also encouraging that there are still some of the mounds out there that haven't been destroyed by farmers or treasure hunters or artifact hunters, for that matter. I find it amazing knowing in the 1800s how actively they were taking apart in this country. They were taking apart just about every mound they could find to see if there were, you know, any artifacts in them that they could take home and put on the mantelpiece. Unfortunately, ignoring the fact that they were destroying historical evidence, but
right, and burial sites.
Yeah, I think the one thing that you've mentioned that is so fascinating to me is the lack of children's bones in places, and I'm wondering if there was just such a high mortality rate that you know, children didn't live long enough to be big enough to really be buried. You know, that possibly, you know, the infant mortality rate was so high that they just didn't survive long enough to become, I don't know, a person, so to speak. In other words, they didn't make it to 7, 8, 9 years old because of how difficult living must have been at that particular point in time.
I think also it was probably more people of standing in the community, like the chief and those type people that were buried in the mounds. Not everybody was buried there. So that's probably another reason you don't find a lot of children.
Yeah, very few of them actually rose to that kind of level of taking care of things. And possibly if it was a child of a leader or something like that, that might have happened.
Right.
But
right, and it could be that's what the Willow Island man could be, that one young person that was buried in there could have been, you know, a son of a chief or something, or whatever they were at that period.
Well, I think one of the things that so fascinates me about that particular time frame, of course, there are no written records and very few...
Right.
Glyphs of any sort that you can get an idea as to what community was like or what their way of life was like. So what you've been able
to... Did we lose you, Barbara? Oh, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, I think Barbara pushed the wrong button.
Oh.
She's probably calling in. So, do child burials, it seems like most researchers are pretty thorough, but do child burials survive, or even the indications that there was a child placed in a mound, do their bones last very long? I just wonder if there's like a...
It was profound. And what, Mark?
Oh, I think you disappeared there for a minute.
Oh, I'm still here.
Okay.
But you know, I think that's one thing that so many people are curious about, as to, you know, well, who did they worship? What did they worship? And the reality is they were living in harmony with the land, and that was their religion to a great, you know, if you want to call it a religion, but it was a spiritual connection to the land that was very profound. And I don't think we give them credit for that.
And part of the reason is because there are no tangible records of that,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Just
nothing
just
to be left behind.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's kind of the holistic way of looking at it. You know, you come in with nothing, you go out with nothing. But in the
right.
bones that have been discovered, has there been any indication of disease and stuff like that, or is it basically, you know, natural passing, I guess, is the way I would put it.
I think it's mostly natural.
So natural passing.
So
in many ways, they didn't have the disease that is out there now. And it doesn't appear from what, and I apologize for not being really knowledgeable in this field, but it doesn't appear that there were quote unquote wars or battles or, you know, of any great magnitude, so that people kind of lived in peace and tranquility to a certain, I mean, I know it was a rough life, but they didn't go attacking of each other and trying to seize possessions and things like that. Or it doesn't appear that they did.
We just don't, there's not real, a lot of evidence of that, but like I was saying earlier, during the Fort Ancient period, when they started building palisades around the village, it was probably a little bit more competitive.
Yeah.
And it could have been people, you know, just having a bad year with crops and then wanting to just steal from your neighbors or something, but you find the palisades then.
Well, yeah, it wasn't because there were that many wild animals that were preying upon the populace. So I would imagine it had to be from other humans that they were trying to defend themselves. But we are running close to being out of time here, and I do so thank you for being here. This has been very illuminating, and I hope that it has in many ways stimulated a greater awareness and a curiosity, because these artifacts and these mounds, and I mean, there's Monk's Mound. There are so many sites across the whole country that date back so very, very far that we should be aware of. That we should understand the cultures that were here, you know, before you know the Europeans invaded and destroyed as much as they could.
Right.
And they didn't bring. They didn't bring a higher level of awareness of religion or spirituality, because I think the people living here had a greater handle on the spiritual stuff. But they did gift us with, you know, disease and all sorts of other things that we probably could have done without.
All right.
So can you imagine how amazing this country might have been had the Europeans not invaded? I mean,
right.
It could have been spectacular, and because of the ignorance of the Europeans, and of course that's where my family comes from, so I take a small bit of blame here, but we destroyed something that could have been a far more beautiful type of culture had we kept our hands off.
Right.
But that said,
I agree.
I want to thank you for being here. I want to thank you for sharing your knowledge and your wisdom with us. And I want to, you know, just it is so nice to know that people quietly are out there trying to not only preserve but to learn about our past. And as somebody once said, that if you don't learn about the foundation upon which your culture is built, it will crumble and you'll have to go back to square one. And I think that in many mm-hmm. cases, that's where we are today. You know, we don't understand where we came from and how we evolved to this point in time, and we are not paying attention to our past, so that we don't have a good foundation for the present, and we have no foundation for the future. So what the work that you're doing is far more important than so many people realize, and it is crucial that we understand this part of our heritage in order to be able to take it forward and incorporate it into supposedly what we've learned today. I think that the work you're doing so quietly is so profoundly important, and I do thank you for all of your work and all of your efforts. I do want to remind people to go to Amazon and look for your books, to check out your website, and take a look at the work that you're doing. It's not primitive work. It's intricate work, and it is so important that we understand, you know, this part of our history. So that said, I'm going to pull this to an end and thank everybody for listening and thank our guests and thank Mark. And if you
yep.
have enjoyed this, please, please, please go to a YouTube channel and subscribe to it. The show is going to be there tomorrow sometime, and then I highly encourage you to not only listen to the show, but then to research some of the material that has been put out there by our amazing guests. So that said, good night, Mark.
Yep. Hey, good night, Barbara. Thank you so much for producing, and thank you, Darla, for being our special guest tonight. We'll see everyone.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. We'll see everyone Monday and Tuesday of next week with two more guests premiering their books.
Absolutely. Thanks again, and good night, everybody.
Good night.